Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, supported by great listeners, including two guys named Michael. Michael Tria, Michael McMillan, Margaret Anderson, and Robert Donjacour. If you're able and you'd like to help out, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Our voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month, and the links are on the right-hand side of my homepage. In our second segment today, Bill Hartung returns to detail the lobbying attention and campaign cash being showered on members of the so-called Super Committee, especially key Democratic members. And Gary Chu, our official movie reviewer, tells us about a new flick called Margin Call. That's all ahead on the PBC podcast.
This ain't no technological breakdown. Oh no, this is the road.
All across the country and around the world, Occupy protesters are trying to divert us off the road to hell. And Kevin Zeese, one of the organizers of the October 2011 movement that is camped out at Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., joins us from the nation's capital today for an update. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, good to have you on. Thank you, Peter.
Well, it's good to talk to you. How is life, without a regular shower and the opportunity to shave and bathe and keep warm?
It has its challenging moments, for sure. Today's actually a gorgeous day. It's almost like spring today, but we've had one day with rain, snow, and sleet. We've had one day with our hurricane watch. We've had the lightning storm, so we've had our share of weather, but right now it's a nice day. So
well,
we're doing fine.
And we are speaking here on Wednesday, November 2nd, and this podcast will be released this afternoon. But I did want to start off with an expression of solidarity for many of my friends who are on strike in Oakland today. And I think that the idea of a general strike is something that I fully support. I think it's a way to expand this movement into the ranks of working people, and that there are many working people who share the concerns but are chained to their desks or a cash register. And I think that in Oakland we're seeing a lot of businesses and even the city support this by giving people the opportunity to take the day off.
Yes, and we endorsed that. The October 2011 movement endorsed that strike as well in Oakland. We think that the overreaction by the police and the city government, I'm glad to see the mayor has changed her tune and is more open now, but the initial reaction that led to the police violence is exactly the wrong response. All people in these occupations are doing is exactly what the Constitution says we should do as people, you know, seeking a more perfect union. We are assembling under our constitutional right to assembly, which should not be abridged, and redressing grievances. And that's what the revolution was fought for. And now we have to refight it with cities like Oakland and New York and Chicago and Denver, where the police are, rather than protecting our constitutional rights, working to undermine them.
And Kevin, this movement is about 45, 46 days old now. And people like me and on occasion me have been urging this leaderless, consensus-based movement to develop some rhetorical initiatives to at least identify the issues that these groups are protesting about and rallying around. And I think we're starting to see that. First up, I want to talk about the Occupied Washington Post, because you and your group there at Freedom Plaza published the first edition, and I'm going to link to it so people can find it via my website as they're listening to this podcast. But tell us a little bit about this this publication, the Occupied Washington Post, and how you plan to use it.
Well, basically, we felt like the media was giving us a false story that people don't know what we stand for. The people who are occupying these plazas know what we stand for. We see the corruption of government by big money, and we see the unfairness of the economy that results from the crony capitalism that corruption creates, and the economic insecurity of Americans. And if you look at the Occupied Washington Post, you'll see as our top story, we stand for human needs, not corporate greed, and we also list seven issues where supermajorities of Americans are already correct on the issues. And if we just put those seven issues in place, we would have a transformation of our government. Right now, the government's going the wrong direction on all those. We support the supermajorities of Americans. We're more in the mainstream with the American people than the Congress is. And that's what we're trying to get across, is that we stand for very clear steps toward ending corporate rule and shifting power to the people.
And let me read these seven bullet points so people understand explicitly what you're talking about. Tax the rich and corporations. End the wars, bring the troops home, cut military spending. Protect the social safety net, strengthen Social Security, and provide improved Medicare for all. End corporate welfare for oil companies and other big business interests. Transition to a clean energy economy, reverse environmental degradation. Protect worker rights, including collective bargaining, create jobs and raise wages. And finally, get money out of politics. Now, I think this is a very good agenda that does, as you say, enjoy supermajority support. And I am pleased to see this coming forward. Now, to what extent do you believe this is being embraced or will be embraced by the general assemblies of Occupy movements across the country and around the world?
Well, the October 2011 movement, which... If you go to OccupyWashingtonDC.org, you can find us on the web. We started almost seven months ago, back in April, May, to organize this. And throughout that time period, one issue that kept coming up in we had a general assembly by conference call and Skype, but our 45-person steering committee that organized this kept asking the question, what is our demand? What do we want? What do we want to see? And so we've been revisiting this issue for months and months and months, and so we've been able to kind of, I think, get a head start on most of the Occupy movement, which didn't start till September 17th when the Wall Street occupation began. So my guess is that as the occupiers look at the issues, they will reach very much the same conclusion that we reach. I've been on conference calls with large numbers of occupiers, 125-person conference calls, for example, and it's a common thing. To hear talk about getting money out of politics and the need to reform the way we run campaigns, the focus on ending Citizens United and corporate personhood. And so I think people are starting to move into those kinds of directions. My guess is as they get into this further, they'll reach the same conclusion we reach, which is the twin evils of corporatism and militarism are what need to end, and that we should direct our compass toward ending corporate rule. When the goal is end corporate rule, then lots of issues fall into place. On healthcare, it means get the insurance industry out from between the doctor and the patient. On banking, it means break up the big banks that are too big to fail and shift more power to smaller banks, especially community banks and credit unions, so money stays in the community rather than going to Wall Street. On issue after issue, when you set your compass at end corporate rule, the solutions become pretty clear.
And help me out to the extent you can, because I realize that you are not in charge, neither am I. But how would you argue for strategy and tactics going forward to advance these goals?
Well, there's lots of discussion of next steps beyond occupation, building this into a movement, not just a short-term occupation of public space. So people are actually discussing those kinds of issues, how we move forward, what next steps we're going to advocate. There's talks about bus tours to go to colleges and main streets across the country, talk to local media, local newspaper editorial boards and radio so people can understand what we're talking about. There's talk about mass events in Washington, D.C., of tens of thousands occupying Washington, D.C. So I think you're going to see we are at the beginning of this movement, not at the end. If you go to our website, OccupyWashingtonDC.org, you'll see an article I wrote called A Warning to the Elites, and it talks about the next steps I see that are coming likely, why we're doing what we're doing, and how the elites should start paying attention now, because if they don't, the price will just get stiffer. We'll, in the end, if they don't react well to what the obvious needs of this country are, ending the corporate corruption and shifting power to the people, then we're going to see more demands made that will the elites will like even less.
Well, I have in front of me your document here, Occupying Public Space is the Beginning of an American Revolt. And
that's right.
I think it's very well stated, Kevin, because you outline some of the issues that we've touched on. And you say, we occupy Washington, D.C. because it is where big business money combines with campaign laws that corrupt government so that it does not respond to the people. Washington, D.C. is corporate occupied territory with 18,000 professional lobbyists, most who work for business interests pushing the agenda of concentrated wealth. And in our second segment, Bill Hartung is going to talk about the lobbyists deployed just for the 12 members of the so-called super committee who are being encouraged to take drastic cuts to social spending in this country and avoid cutting defense spending. And I think that that is an immediate area of focus that I'd like to see the Occupy movement address.
Well, in fact, next week what we're doing on Freedom Plaza is having our own People's Super Committee that will be looking at exactly these issues and coming forth with a alternative to the highly corrupted Super Committee in Congress recommends. We are going to be looking at shifting taxes so that we tax wealth more and work less. We're going to be talking about the financial transaction tax when people buy stocks, bonds, and derivatives, that they pay a sales tax, just like we pay a sales tax when we buy necessities like food and clothing and even shelter with a property tax. And so we're going to be recommending that, as well as the cuts in the military budget that are necessary. So we're going to have our own committee hearing in order to show what the people would really want to see happen. And it will be very consistent with those seven items and other polling that shows what the American people want.
And let me close with your closing comment here, or let me read this. A message for the elites. This is just the beginning. Listen to us now, or the price of change will get more expensive for you. What do we seek? We seek an end to corporate rule and shifting power to the people. Now, that's a very straightforward statement. And I don't think you intend it as a mean threat, but I do think you intend it as an ultimatum.
Well, I mean, I want to be clear. I'm tired of this nonsensical comments from the corporate media that doesn't seem able to understand that we want to end corporate rule. It's not surprising, since you have six media stations that own the news. You have conglomerates that own the newspapers. They are the corporate rulers we're trying to end. So they may not want to hear the message, but the message is clear. I think the people support it, and the people understand it. And so the corporate media, as long as they keep saying the message is not clear, the more their credibility is going to keep dropping.
Now, Kevin, as we try to fit this into the political cycle and the elections occurring in the coming year, it's pretty clear that Republicans are limited in their ability to respond because they're lock, stock, and barrel owned by corporate interests and really philosophically aligned. And so the play is really with the Democrats. And to date, while President Obama and Democratic leaders have given some lip service to the Occupy movement, it's very clear to me that they're interested in tweaks and in very minor changes with a big media flourish and hype, but they're not really prepared to address the critical underlying problems that you are identifying. So
exactly right. I don't see the electoral system able to respond right now. It's too corrupt. We need to, at this point, not focus on elections. We need to focus on building a movement that will pressure both parties, no matter who gets elected. The odds are we'll have, in this year of Occupy Wall Street and the strong anti-Wall Street big finance sentiment, we're going to have probably two Wall Street candidates in Mitt Romney and President Obama. So it'll be the exact opposite of what the people want. I don't see it as really worth our time. We need to instead focus on building a movement, building our own independent media, and using that to pressure, just like movements have done in the past. If the government does not respond in the next 4 years, I suspect you'll see a very strong third-party movement develop that will actually diminish one of the parties. And just as the Whigs disappeared, we can expect to see one of these two parties, one of these two corporate parties disappear as well.
And so your view is that it's pointless to attempt to use this leverage?
The election system is a mirage. It's a mirage. Nothing is going to change sufficiently as far as money in politics and the role of the media in covering certain candidates. The Debate Commission, which is a private corporation funded by big business and controlled by the two parties, to allow people to debate, that will not happen. And so we just don't see this. It's a mirage democracy. And so we shouldn't waste our energy on it. We should spend our energy building something that's not a mirage, and that's our own power. And our own power can pressure both political parties, and if they don't respond, then we can move to an electoral system in the next election cycle.
Mm. Well, that means that you're in for a very long-term commitment,
least
4 to 6 years.
If you look at my economic site, it's oureconomy.us. I published a memo by Lewis Powell from 40 years ago this August because it was the anniversary, and it's a memo that he lays out a plan for corporations to take control of Congress, the White House, the courts, the media, universities, public journals, universities, all key segments of the society that set the direction of the country. And they've successfully done that. It's taken them decades to do it. It's not going to be undone in one occupation. It's a multi-year effort, and we can do it. I'm confident we can do this, but we have to recognize this is a marathon, not a sprint.
Now, you've been involved with the Move to Amend effort related to the misguided Supreme Court decision in Citizens United. Do you believe at this point that a constitutional convention or a series of constitutional amendments is the appropriate way to try to fix the very serious problems that we agree on?
I think the key issues on getting money out of politics, ending corporate personhood, those two issues I think need to be fixed by a constitutional amendment or some kind of decision by the Supreme Court reversing itself. So I think we need to move in the direction of a constitutional amendment on both those issues. That's not the only issue we should be doing, but I think those are important to do. I think that the avenue that makes a lot of sense to me is the constitutional convention, but limiting the issues of corporate personhood, corporations are not humans, and getting money out of politics.
Mm-hmm. And is it possible to convene a constitutional convention that has a limited agenda? That's one of my big concerns.
Yes, that's a concern. Everyone has it. I believe it is possible.
Uh-huh.
I think we can do that.
Mm-hmm. All right.
It's never been tried before, the constitutional convention approach. But so we can define it as we see fit and make it happen, focused on those issues.
All right. Well, Kevin, what would you like to add before we wrap up here? Because
people should come down to Freedom Plaza, whether you're anywhere in the United States. We need people from the United States to come down and join us. We always have lots of good things going on. As I said, we're going to have our own deficit commission meeting hearing next week. Tomorrow night, on Thursday night, we're having Ralph Nader come down at 5 o'clock. People can do that. We're doing a march with National Nurses United tomorrow on the financial transactions tax beginning at 11 o'clock. So there's always a lot going on, and so people should come down and visit. Come down, pick up a copy of the Occupied Washington Post.
All right. Kevin Zeese on the scene at Occupy Washington, D.C. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We continue here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And in just a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by Bill Hartung to talk about the whining, dining, and showering of political contributions on the members of the so-called Super Committee who are trying to whack the budget deficit before Thanksgiving. But I wanted to pass along an item that came across my desk. And first, I'll tell you that I tried to get the reporter who wrote this article to join me for an interview. And she very politely responded, "I don't do broadcast. Sorry." Her name is Pam Martens, M-A-R-T-E-N-S. And on October 26th at Counterpunch and at Alternet, she published a story that should be front page news. And I haven't seen it anywhere else except online. And that is that on Wall Street and Lower Manhattan in New York City, the corporations are sitting alongside the New York Police Department monitoring video surveillance that covers just about the entire Lower Manhattan area. And the surveillance plan is known as the Lower Manhattan Security Initiative. And they have a 24-hour command post called the Lower Manhattan Security Coordination Center. They have 2,000 private spy cameras owned by Wall Street firms and 1,000 more that are controlled by the New York Police Department. So there are 3,000 video cameras, essentially blanketing Lower Manhattan, that relay live video feeds of people on the streets to this center. At least 700 additional cameras scour Midtown Manhattan and relay their feeds into this same downtown center. And here's what's really important. Not only do they have these cameras, but there are representatives of these corporations that sit side by side with the cops. Now, does Goldman Sachs have a stack of gold bars in the basement that they require maximum security to protect, and therefore the cops allow a Goldman Sachs security official to sit in a public facility and monitor the actions of citizens who are largely oblivious to this surveillance? So, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Federal Reserve, New York Stock Exchange all have representatives who are permitted to have an on-site representative. Mayor Bloomberg announced in October of 2009 the Midtown Manhattan Security Initiative will add additional cameras and license plate readers between 30th and 60th Street. So what we have is a hardwired police state creeping north from Wall Street to Midtown, and presumably this will ultimately cover the entire island of Manhattan. And this is a remarkable, remarkable development. And she goes on to say that the Tisch family, one of the Tisches was the head of CBS and owned controlling interest in CBS television for a number of years until they sold it to Viacom, which owns it now. And the Tisch family has long been powerful in New York, and they own the Lowe's Corporation, which is a tobacco company and hotel operation. I'm sorry, Lowe's is the hotel. Lorillard is the tobacco company they own, if I remember right. And the Tisch family stands to directly benefit from the surveillance program because they appear to be running this for profit and billing back the Wall Street bankers, and it appears the New York Police Department. So we have public surveillance operated for profit by a private company and monitored jointly by police officials and security goons from the big Wall Street banks and other financial institutions. Now that is worth occupying Wall Street over in and of itself.
Can't touch this. Can't touch this.
As we speak and as you listen,
touch this.
There is a super duper committee in Washington, D.C., tasked with meeting mostly behind closed doors to achieve deficit reduction. But it's a game of can't touch this. They should have MC Hammer on the committee. He doesn't have anything better to do these days. And at least their work might rhyme and have a beat to it.
Can't touch this. Yeah, that's how we living and you know. Can't touch this.
And of course, what is on the table, but not really, is massive cuts to defense spending. William D. Hartung returns to our program today. He was with us this past March, and you can still find the podcast at peterbcollins.com. His book, Prophets of War, profiles Lockheed Martin and the buildup of the military-industrial complex in this country. And we welcome his contributions again today. Bill, how are you?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm fine, and I appreciate the work that you're doing. This super committee was formed this past July because of the deadlock between the Republicans who caused the deficit and now want it sharply reduced, and the Democrats who didn't want to see cuts in social spending beyond the bone. And what we've seen here is a scrimmage that is mostly around the, 12% of discretionary spending that's in the federal budget, and the rest of it is just kind of window dressing for the most part, would you say, or am I off base?
No, I think you're right. They've pretty much focused on the discretionary budget, and of course the Pentagon is far and away the biggest part of discretionary spending. So I would say, if things played out the way they seem to be, and if they actually quote unquote succeeded and found $1.2 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years, Pentagon would get off fairly lightly.
Mm-hmm.
If they fail, there's supposed to be automatic cuts, quite substantial, which the Pentagon might come in for about $600 billion over 10 years, which seems like a lot to us, is not really that much to them.
Mm-hmm.
But if that happens. The Pentagon's allies in Congress have already said, well, we will overturn the part that involves the Pentagon, which means the if that were the case, the domestic cuts might stick and the Pentagon cuts might get withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a difficult circumstance.
Yep, can't touch this. And, of course, we've announced that we're pulling all of our troops out of Iraq. And have they factored in the Iraq peace dividend bill?
Well, there are kind of two approaches. One is to keep the war spending to the side and say, well, let's just look at the Pentagon budget, which is not bad in the sense that the Pentagon budget then would take a bigger hit, whereas when they count the war spending, they have this kind of fancy accounting where they say, well, what if we spent forever what we spent this year on Iraq or Afghanistan? Then anything less than that is savings. But, of course, Iraq is thankfully winding down. Afghanistan, we don't know where it's going to happen, 3, 4, 10 years from now. So they've mostly kept the war budget to the side, but when they want to kind of look like they're cutting, they'll throw in unrealistic numbers for that and then say, well, anything below that is saving. So there's a lot of a bit of a shell game going on.
I agree. And it's very hard. They've had a couple of public hearings, but most of this is going on behind closed doors.
Yes. And so, it gives an inside track to the lobbyists, of course, because they have connections. They have people who used to work for these folks, now working for them. And since there's no disclosure of who they're meeting and when they're meeting them, it's probably safe to assume that the lobbyists are working them full-time, whereas the rest of us, couldn't get an email answered.
So. Right, yeah. Well, you could attend a fundraiser.
Yes. Or at least I could work the door.
Now, Bill, you have authored a report co-released by the Center for International Policy, where you're on staff, and Common Cause, a great public interest organization. And it's called Tools of Influence, the Arms Lobby and the Super Committee. And what you show is that the members of this super committee, a handpicked group of senators and members of the House of Representatives, particularly Democrats, have received heavy campaign contributions from the industry, the defense contractors, that they are presumably wrestling over budgets for. And they're going to have a hard time, aren't they, cutting budgets in the public interest when their self-interest is in the campaign contributions that they get from these huge military corporations.
Well, yes. I mean, they're being flooded with special interest money of all sorts, but I think the Pentagon contractors have somewhat of a leg up. I mean, not only have they given them $1.1 million in the last couple election cycles just to the 12 members of the super committee, but they've got 22 former employees of these folks working for them as lobbyists. So they're working for Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics and Northrop Grumman and Raytheon. As we discussed, who are they meeting with? These are undoubtedly some of the folks they're meeting with. And then add to that, the Aerospace Industries Association, which is funded by all these contractors, has been doing this big scare campaign about jobs, saying if we cut a penny more, unemployment is going to go up dramatically. So between the jobs card and the revolving door and the money and the just general wrapping themselves in the flag and claiming, you know, we can't defend ourselves for less than these record levels we're spending now, they have a lot of different angles they can play to try to keep spending pretty much where it is.
And the jobs card you mentioned is in play. I just saw it in evidence today. I read every morning an online digest of all the political reporting in California, and it brought up a story from the Riverside Press Democrat saying that if the super committee makes the cuts or if it fails to and the triggers kick in, that 7,000 jobs in Riverside, San Bernardino counties will be lost. Now, it's a threat that is very hard to really detail, but even if there are cuts, it's hard to imagine that all 7,000 of those jobs would be cut. Nevertheless, a press release was delivered, the newspaper published it, and that's how the industry ratchets up fear about the impact of defense cuts on the domestic economy.
Yes, they just released a big study. You know, and of course, if it's paid for by the arms industry, you might want to be a little skeptical. But they did sort of nationwide figures and statewide figures and, you know, down to the community level. So probably that report was some sort of spinoff from that, mm-hmm. influenced by it. And, you know, a few of us looked at, you know, where did they come up with their numbers. And basically, they did a couple things. First of all, they assumed that, you know, worst case scenario of what the cuts might be. Then they assumed they were going to start tomorrow, you know, when in fact the distances by the committee won't kick in until 2013.
Right.
Then they assumed it's going to be parceled out evenly over, you know, the years, when in fact, you know, when you cut a weapons program, it kind of takes a while before that kicks into the system.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, they said, well, you know, a dollar spent directly on the guys, you know, men and women producing this thing will support, you know, another two jobs because they spend their money, there's other suppliers and so forth. And economists, you know, sort of mainstream economists said, well, you know, it shouldn't be 2-to-1, maybe it should be something like 1-to-1. So they probably doubled their estimate from what would be, you know, a real assessment. And, of course, it's going to be difficult for the people in the industry, but in terms of the economy as a whole, almost anything else creates more jobs. So if you're cutting domestic programs to save the Pentagon, you're going to lose more jobs than you save for police and firefighters and teachers and people all over the country. So,
oh, there you go again with a rational argument.
it's kind of like you look at the presidential debates and it's, you know, is this even going to make it in the door, you know, any kind of factual information.
Yeah, this is the kind of argument that John Huntsman would be ignored for.
and certainly has been, yes.
Well, I don't want to go all Keith Olbermann on you and go worst persons, but as I look at this, it's hard to decide whether Senator Patty Murray, the Democrat from Washington State, the senator from Boeing, is more roguish than Buck McKean, who is the House Armed Services Committee chair and a Republican from here in California. Do you want to choose? Should we flip a coin?
Well, I think McKeon is worse in the sense that he is the industry's point man for this stuff. So not only does he get $750,000 a year, but he's got Lockheed Martin's, you know, big research facility there. He's got Northrop Grumman's drone factory. He's got Boeing in his district. And so he is the one who's kind of, you know, quarterbacking the industry and the Pentagon as to what their kind of PR story should be, how to hammer the jobs issue, how to push, ratchet up the fear of China. So I would say he's perhaps a more active advocate for the industry. I think Patty Murray, it's kind of traditional pork barrel politics. She's got Boeing in her state, mm-hmm. and she's going to help them whenever possible. So I would give him the edge. I think she is she's indicative of what the problem with our Congress, which is that the industry spread this money all over the place. And then they sort of point to the jobs, and then even otherwise liberal members, you know, vote with them. So it's I think it's sort of two pronged. But I think McKeon is kind of plays more of a leadership role, which is not anything to be proud of, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And let's just tick off on the Senate side. It's Patty Murray from Washington, Max Baucus from Montana, an alleged Democrat, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, And then on the Republican side, Rob Portman, an Ohio Republican who was in the Bush administration and is kind of a darling of the Republicans. They see him as a future player. John Kyle from Arizona, who is a hardliner for the nuclear industry. And Senator Pat Toomey, the freshman Republican from Pennsylvania, out of the Club for Growth. And it's interesting that Toomey, Kyle, and Portman trail their Democratic counterparts in contributions from the defense industry. So as you analyze this, Bill Hartung, is that because their loyalties are all already well in place and they don't need to be further greased? Or is it the flip side, that these Democrats need encouragement from their defense friends to keep those budgets high?
Well, I think there is a factor that the Republicans are going to vote for high budgets regardless, and so there's less need to, you know, curry their favor. There's also the fact of, you know, what positions these people hold. You know, so Patty Murray heads the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. She's on the Appropriations Committee. So she's got some sway not only over her colleagues but over the directly over the military budget. James Clyburn is, you know, second deputy in the House, second highest ranking member. So I think that's part of it. If you look at, you know, more generally, the industry tends to split its money fairly evenly, and they'll give a little more to the people in power, a little less to the people out of power. So they really, they sort of follow not so much ideology or parties, but who's in a position to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of how they invest their money. So, you know, I think it's a little bit tilted because of the nature of the folks on the committee. And, you know, you're right, somebody like John Kyle, how much more could he be in the tank for the, you know, military industry? I mean, it's sort of, you know, why spend money on that when you could actually try to influence somebody who's might be sitting on the fence?
And Max Baucus is number two in terms of industry contributions, $91,000 to his reelection committee and $52,000 to his leadership PAC. Will he screw the American people here just as nicely as he did on the so-called health care reform?
Well, I think that that's certainly a danger. I mean, basically...
Let me just say, that was certainly a loaded question. I apologize, but I couldn't resist.
How might this money influence Mr. Baucus's approach to the super committee? Well, he, I think at a minimum he'll be neutralized in the sense that... you know, he won't be an active advocate for making Pentagon cuts part of the mix of the super committee's proposals. And there's this whole background, which is that the Secretary of Defense Panetta and the industry are kind of hand in hand on this, saying, well, we've already cut $450 billion, which is the administration's number that they're throwing out there. But that is, first of all, if they did it, would basically just be kind of a haircut for the Pentagon. I mean, they would still grow with inflation from what are record post-World War II levels. So it's not a big deal for them. But also, these are theoretical cuts that might happen in the future. And the kind of scare campaign makes it sound like they're happening as we speak.
And let's take a moment here and talk about Brother Leon, because I knew Leon Panetta as a member of Congress. He chaired the Budget Committee. He took people to Andrews Air Force Base in the early 90s to put together a round of budget cuts and tax increases to balance the budget and put us on a path to surplus, which is what really was his legacy at the end of the Clinton administration. He went on to serve as OMB director and then White House chief of staff for Bill Clinton. And as he was brought in first as CIA director and now as the Secretary of Defense, these are not flip-flops. These are, personality disorders. This is a huge change from the Leon Panetta of the 1990s. And to hear him testifying before Congress and basically saying that, I'm paraphrasing in the worst here, but threatening that Americans will die if we cut the defense budget. And as you point out in your report, the Pentagon budget has grown at a faster pace. The contracts have increased 2.5 times during the last decade, from $144 billion to $400 billion in fiscal year 2010. And this is unsustainable. And it, you know, he seems to want to play the threat card to the extreme and not recognize the risk to our nation of this continued expansive defense spending. We cannot afford to do this. And yet we are told that we are we can't afford to think about it. That's what we're basically being told is just shut up, sit down, and don't make any waves, because if you do, America will be hurt.
Yeah, it's very reminiscent of Caspar Weinberger when he was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Defense, who basically said, there's not a dime that we can cut from the Pentagon. There's no waste. There's no weapon systems we don't need. There's no need to reconsider, you know, kind of our role in the world. And, of course, Reagan, you know, he wasn't fighting two wars with, you know, hundreds of thousands of boots on the ground. So that in some sense, they were pocketing that money, you know, even more so than now. But the Panetta turnaround is, you know, extremely disappointing. There was some, like a little moment there when people said, well, maybe they brought him in because they are going to make cuts and he knows how budgets work. But, you know, almost right out of the gate, he has been, you know, engaging in this kind of scaremongering. Because, I mean, do we need 5,000 nuclear weapons? Do they have anything to do with protecting our troops? You know, do you need to build fighter planes that don't work, that are overpriced? Do you need, you know, the 10th aircraft carrier task force when China basically is, you know, refurbishing a used one that they got from the Russians? You know, so all of these things that are in the budget are really excess. And to the extent that they're usable for sort of a global reach military strategy that really not only can't afford, but I don't think makes sense security grounds and moral grounds and political grounds. So he's really defending the status quo that, as you said, is not sustainable and is not the direction we should be going in.
Well, and if we look back at the 1990s, when we had these BRACs, these base closure review panels, and it was a cumbersome way to deal with shrinking the military budget, but it did have some transparency to it. It was a process that allowed states to say, oh, we're going to die if you close our base. And, you know, there were some adjustments made along the way. But there was a process where there was a whole reevaluation of what was needed. And I find it breathtaking, Bill, that we're heading into this process right now that is high stakes, with the triggers that are on the table if this super committee doesn't come up with the gruesome cuts that they've been tasked with. But there is no broad-based blueprint to say, well, yeah, this is what we need. We do need to keep troops in Okinawa, but we don't need to keep troops, say, in Kuwait. And there's no rational approach to really determining these things. And the super committee is basically just in there with a chainsaw trying to make cuts for the purpose of a press release that will surface right before Thanksgiving. So this whole process seems to be untethered and off base to me.
Well, the administration has said they're going to do a policy review, which is supposed to come out sometime soon, but it's being conducted by the same people who did the prior review, which basically said, we're doing great, no need to change anything. If anything, there's some areas where we should spend more. So it's unlikely that this same group is going to suddenly come up with a kind of strategic plan that actually gives up anything, changes the missions, you know, reassesses the role of our military in the world, which is what's needed. I mean, especially at a time when we can't afford this stuff, it would be nice if the Pentagon said, well, you know, here's a better plan that relates to the resources that we might get under a reasonable, you know, budget scenario. So instead of doing that, they're just digging in their heels and trying to keep everything they have, which, you know, among other things, even if there were, you know, say there were cuts, they would not be prepared for them. I mean, they wouldn't be figuring out what they need and what they don't need. It would be like in Iraq, where it's like, you know, oh, well, gee, do we need armored vehicles to protect the troops? We didn't think of that. You know, or should we be spending money to dismantle nuclear weapons in the former Soviet Union so they're not stolen by terrorists? Oh, gee, you know, we didn't keep that money in the budget. You know, so things that might be needed could easily get elbowed out of the way because of the lack of planning.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there like a long-term loss of funding, missing money at the Pentagon? I seem to recall that on September 10th of 2001, a report was issued and soon forgotten about billions of missing dollars from Pentagon budgets. And I'm wondering if in his retirement, Don Rumsfeld is out looking for that the way O.J. was looking for the real killer.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate that Rumsfeld wrote that book because he really had disappeared, which was one of the few, you know, pleasant developments of recent years. You know, the Pentagon budget is not able to be audited. It's not in good enough shape that an audit can be performed. So it's believed that there could be hundreds of billions of dollars that have accumulated over the years. They just don't know where they went.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did they spend them, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan? One of these strategies was throw cash around, you know, big bundles of cash to give to the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, to give to, you know, local contractors in Iraq, to, you know, buy off this or that faction. So some of that money undoubtedly just disappeared into the pockets of contractors or bureaucrats and so forth. But there's also things like they don't know what they have in inventory, you know, so they will rebuild new things, parts and other things when they have perfectly good parts sitting somewhere, and they just don't know about them. They're not communicating with each other within the system. So, you know, if the Pentagon were on some kind of reasonable accounting system, that alone would save huge amounts of money.
We're talking with Bill Hartung from the Center for International Policy here on the Peter B. Collins Show, and I will link to Bill's report called Tools of Influence in the show file related to this podcast. And that, of course, is at peterbcollins.com. Bill, now let's take a look at the members of Congress on this super committee. The top two recipients of defense contributions are James Clyburn, as you mentioned. He is a high-ranking Democrat in the House. Chris Van Hollen, who I believe is the number three in the House leadership, or maybe it's number four now. He clocks in second there. And Javier Becerra, who is from Los Angeles, which is a hotbed of contracting, is a relative piker, 6,000 to his leadership PAC and 31,000 to his campaign committee. And for my money, he's the only real New Deal Democrat on this entire committee. And I'm hoping that he's having an impact there, pushing back on some of the safety net and social spending cuts that are really in the sights of the Republicans. But I'm curious, there are two Republicans from the state of Michigan, both relatively backbenchers, Fred Upton and Dave Camp. At least I haven't heard much of them before. How did Michigan get two seats on this super committee?
You know, that's a good question. I was sort of puzzling over that myself. You know, it has been a swing state in some elections, but, you know, so have many others. You know, there's defense interests in Michigan, you know, tanks and so forth. But, of course, that's not the only factor that the leadership in the House and Senate were considering when they assigned these people to the super committee. So I really don't understand it, and I don't know why they didn't get more grief from other parts of the country saying, well, you know, what about our state? What about our region? You know, who's speaking for us? So it's I haven't really been able to get to the bottom of that.
Are they Tea Party guys, Camp or Upton? Again, I don't know that much about them.
I think Camp is kind of a Tea Party, you know, I don't think he came in on the Tea Party wave, but I think he's certainly sympathetic to that you know, faction.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also have Table 1 here, which is the revolving door. And this shows that, for example, a guy named Shay Michael Hancock, who works for Denny Miller Associates. Sounds like a place to have breakfast. He used to work for Patty Murray, the senator from Washington State, and he is now a lead lobbyist for Boeing. And since he used to work for Patty Murray, he probably knows her BlackBerry phone number, Can probably get a message through to the home office in the evening. What other benefits do former employees have when they leave government service in order to lobby their former boss, Bill?
Well, of course they make boatloads of money, and you know that can affect their behavior when they're in government because they're already looking ahead and saying, well, you know, if I give one of these contractors a hard time, or we sponsor legislation that, you know, undercuts their financial interests in some way, you know, I'm going to be damaged goods if I go to work as a lobbyist. I'm not going to make as much money and so forth. So I think it even starts before they go out into the lobbying world. And then when they are there, I think you've sort of covered the main aspect, which is they have preferential access to the former members.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to, you know, it's hard to beat that if somebody was your chief of staff or they were a key player in your office. It's very unlikely you're going to say, oh, sorry, can't talk to you. You know, I'm in this little bubble. I'm not going to let anybody influence me. Where it is quite easy to see how if somebody from a, you know, a good government group or a taxpayer group or a, you know, arms control group was trying to get their foot in the door, it would be much more difficult.
The other piece is the indirect, and that is that Shea Hancock knows the people who Patty Murray listens to, because he was there working for her and knows, for example, when a VP of Boeing called and she responded. So as these things play out and as certain programs or projects come up for review, then it's pretty easy for a lobbyist like Hancock to figure out, oh, yeah, well, let's have Senator Feinstein call Senator Murray. We know that they agree on this particular program, say the drone program.
Right, right. And they sort of know the congressional coalitions that have been built in the past on some of these issues, and so they know what members, you know, because undoubtedly they have colleagues who used to work for Feinstein who they can work with. And so it's kind of a... Kind of a snowball effect that happens where they pool their resources in a certain way.
Yeah. Now, Bill, this may be outside your scope, but I'm just curious if the domestic spending on so-called homeland security and the domestic surveillance programs, including the interception of this phone call of ours right now, are these under review in any way? The at the super committee?
Well, they've created this category called security, which includes the Pentagon, it includes the intelligence community, includes Homeland Security, includes the State Department, which has been taking it on the chin as this part of this process. And so, you know, in theory, these things are covered. But, of course, you know, you've probably seen this recent book by Dana Priest and Bill Arkin, Top Secret America.
Yeah.
A lot of this stuff is it's just not being reviewed by the Congress, or a few members look at it under pain of not telling anybody else. So it's hard to know, for example, how they would cut the intelligence budget and know that it's being made to stick.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And a lot of these things kind of filter down from the national to the local level. So you've got local police, you know, with all of these high-tech gizmos that they've gotten and you know, new surveillance techniques and new kind of protocols and so forth. And a lot of that is part of this kind of national surveillance state that came out of the post-9/11 period. So it's sort of like to extract that from our political process would be a difficult and probably long-term process. And it's not clear that it's really part of the mission or agenda or under discussion in these super committee deliberations.
Yeah, and just one example of that, I'm a sailor and I enjoy being out on the water. And I read an article, it was in the New York Times this past spring, that on the Hudson River, people on pleasure boats are stopped as often as four times a day, first by the Coast Guard, then state police, then a county patrol, and then a local water patrol. And I interviewed a top-ranking Coast Guard official, and I said, isn't this a little excessive? And he said, well, you know, since 9/11, a lot of local jurisdictions have gotten government money for water-based security. He said they're out there just proving that they're doing their job and making sure that they get the next round of funding. So we have a lot of mission creep and duplication, and that's not being examined as we make draconian budget cuts that will impact our nation over the next 10 years. But, Bill, another question about process here. What is the super committee actually doing with the Pentagon budget? Are they recommending specific cuts or simply dollar targets for the agency itself to implement and digest?
Those of us who are trying to get a handle on it have been, you know, kind of getting mixed signals about this. You know, one day they'll say, well, you know, they want to know about specific cuts. And the next day they'll say, well, they're just going to give them sort of a feeling that they have to fit under. My guess is, you know, given what a mess the whole thing has been and will be, that if they talk about Pentagon reductions at all, it'll be in the form of, you know, some sort of ceiling, sort of leaving it up to them to figure out how to carry it out. But they have been asking about specific systems and specific kinds of waste that might be targeted. But I think that's more for them to, if they actually came up with a number for cuts, to say, oh, see, there's ways to do it, you know, kind of illustrative.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's how it's going to play out.
All right. And do you have any predictions at this point? Do you think the committee will be able to complete its tasks, or do you think they will ultimately hit gridlock, throw up their hands, and say, bring on the triggers?
Well, I think they might get part of the way there. And one scenario is, you know, say they cut, you know, $800 billion out of their $1.2 trillion, you know, figure, that they pocket that $800 billion and the triggers apply to what's left. You know, so that's a less, you know, dramatic scenario. But mm-hmm. it's also possible that the whole thing will fall apart, which just means it'll be slugged out next year because the super committee's recommendations wouldn't take effect till January 2013. So that, as John McCain said, we wrote the legislation, we can change it. You know, so I think this is in some ways a symbolic exercise, except for the fact that it might set the frame of the debate next year.
And did McCain say that right after arguing that it was a group of Martians that populated the Senate and the House from 2001 to 2009 who ran up this huge deficit? Because they always act like it arrived like a meteorite. And now, oh, golly, we got to do something about it.
Right. And, of course, the Republicans would like to argue that the clock only starts ticking once Obama was elected, when, in fact,
right.
of course, when you start two wars, when you cut taxes, you're going to have deficits. I mean, and it was a huge deficit in the Bush period, which is as if it's been erased from the memories of not only the Republicans, but a lot of the people covering this issue.
Yeah. Bill, thanks for your work, and thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
William D. Hartung, you can find him at the Center for International Policy. And again, I recommend his recent book, which will be out in paperback when, Bill?
Probably March of next year, sooner if I can lean on my publisher.
All right, it's called Prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Prophets of War. Bill Hartung, always a pleasure.
Thanks.
And now, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, Gary Chu, weighs in with his review of the new film called Margin Call.
Margin Call suggests that it not only holds in Washington, D.C., that if you want a friend, maybe you should get a dog. Another venue at which that might work well for you is New York City, especially down along Wall Street. Sam Rogers, a principal character in Margin Call, played by Kevin Spacey, has a dog for his best friend. You see just how close a friend Sam is with his dog in the last scene of this first movie by J.C. Chandor, who also cleanly wrote the crisp, smart script. Margin Call is a fictionalized account of what precipitated the meltdowns of several securities firms in September 2008. The screenplay hints at the event by naming Jeremy Irons' character in the film with a word that melds the last names of two real-life New York investment bankers. The real-life Mr. Thane and Mr. Fold, please meet the fictional head banker dude in Margin Call. Shake hands with Mr. Tulled. John Tull's business motto is, to win, the choices are be first, be smart, or cheat. In another fit of candor, Mr. Tull goes on to say this about currencies. It's just money. It's all made up. But the melting down to take place in 24 hours' time that margin call covers isn't made up at all. It was and is still quite real, and in the film soon to take its toll first on little people, then working its way up to however far what money the firm will have left, keeps the guys near and at the top. On top. One of the little guys, Peter, is played by Zachary Quinto, Star Trek's new and younger Spock. Peter runs the numbers on an under-the-radar project that his boss, Eric, played by Stanley Tucci, is working on just then, when out of the blue, Eric, the boss, gets sacked. Eric has caution for Peter, who is a former rocket scientist. Really, Peter likes Wall Street money better than what he can earn out of the launch pad. Eric says, "Be careful, Peter." That is, watch out, Peter, when checking out rather rattling figures Eric has discovered that indicate the firm is nosing down into tank time at the old Twilight Zone. Peter's boss hasn't had time enough to know if collapse is certain. All the pieces of the puzzle are yet to be found. Peter does find, though, that Eric is onto something. But whoa, by then, security has escorted Eric from the premises and disconnected his communications devices. Wagons are quickly circled during an urgent, through-the-night, high-level meeting with Mr. Tull, Sam, Peter, and other A-listers at the firm. It includes Sarah, played by Demi Moore, a top-floor numbers cruncher who earlier had sounded warnings to the brass that all is not serendipitous in mortgage moneyland. Sarah's message goes something like this: selling things that have no value will likely come back to bite you. Besides Tull, another seemingly unaffected upper echelon manager named Jared moves closer to margin call center stage. Simon Baker, CBS TV's The Mentalist, does that part. As meltdown temperatures rise and the players draw closer to personal choices about what to do, Baker gets off one of the best lines. And amid all the chaos, he says, "What is right takes on multiple interpretations." You think? Baker's turn as Jared gives off reminiscent Sparks Michael Douglas Spawn doing Gordon Gekko. But Baker's character is much less histrionic. In fact, despite the heat of the topic, the movie is nearly without histrionics. It's quiet, deliberate, clearly communicated, even corporate businesslike, though extended chatter goes on some about the statistics that loom on the computer monitors of the major players. And no, you're wrong. The film is not dull. It will nail your attention, with help from non-distracting, low-key but just right music embellishing the tension. Showing just how quickly these people are at thinking in just numbers, Tucci has a wonderful off-topic speech about how building a bridge once saved awesome mega-quantities of years of not having to live in a moving vehicle for many people who drive back and forth to work every day. I'm glad Chandor put those lines in the script. I've always wondered just how fast smart people can run accurate numbers through their heads. Margin Call's calm in the middle of a perfect financial storm lends even more gravity to the narrative. But what's even smarter about the movie? The salesmen in it aren't painted as really bad, but secular, smart, ambitious, and longing to grab their big piece of the American pie. Not always do such motives produce the grim results seen in this film. I suggest another way to describe Margin Call would be hearing the written voice of Arthur Miller, then retitling the film Death of Not Just One, but Many Salesmen, by their own hand. Film reviews by the guy with his voice are at hand online at TulsaTVMemories.com or at the International Movie Database, IMDb.com. Read them. I'm Gary Chu, down in the valley.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Go occupy something and send me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.